There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
And welcome to a Wednesday night. It is Nicole Sandler here with you on Air America Radio on this Wednesday, November 4th, 2009. Yeah, it's a big day. You know, it's 1 year since we elected Barack Obama, the 44th president of the United States. And it also happens to be my 50th birthday. So happy birthday to me. We've got a really, really special show for you tonight. And we're going to start it off with sort of a big picture view of President Obama's, well, it's not been a whole year in office, but it's a year since we elected him. And we're going to take a look at what he's accomplished and in relation to what he possibly could accomplish with a guy who I guess understands the meaning of my theme song, History Repeating. Ralph Nader joins us for a nice, long, in-depth, extensive interview tonight, and I hope you'll stick around for it. We're talking today because you've got a new book out, but it's a difficult to describe book. How do you describe Only the Super Rich Can Save Us?
Well, it's called A Work of Utopian Fiction, but it's practical utopia. And it's in the line of American fictional utopias, such as Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward, that came out in the late 1890s and helped galvanize the progressive populist movement. This story takes place in 2006 in my book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. It's led by Warren Buffett in fictional role, along with 16 other very rich people in fictional roles, including Ted Turner and Phil Donahue, Bill Cosby, and William Gates Sr., and Ted Turner, and Ross Perot, and Yoko Ono, and others.
Wow.
And he convenes them in January 2006 in a mountaintop hotel in Maui, Hawaii. And they basically have a discussion where they say, look, we're in our advanced years. They're in their 70s, 80s, 90s. They want to contribute to resurging our democracy and mobilizing the people for long overdue changes and improvements in our country domestically. And why don't we do it? Well, they all agree that they're going to go full throttle for the entire year. They're dropping everything they're doing. They're going to put billions of dollars in, their own money and money they raise from their rich friends, and they're going to mobilize the community, the grassroots, and they're going to hire thousands of organizers, community lecturers, candidates, people who deal everything from graphic arts to getting huge rallies out in downtown centers of cities around the country like Union Square in San Francisco or Fountain Square in Cincinnati. And that they're going to get mass media. And, of course, they learned as March and April came around that the more they bought the media, the more they got free media from an astonished mass media establishment that was saying, what's going on here? What are these retired or older super rich doing, taking on the corporate bosses and their allies in Washington? So it's a very gripping, I think, type of story. Leslie Stahl read it, and 60 Minutes Leslie Stahl, on her vacation, wrote me a nice note saying she found it, quote, engrossing, creative, and funny, end quote. And I said, I'll take all three. The long book.
Yeah. It is a long book. It's 700 and some odd pages.
But as my answer to Ayn Rand, who, bizarrely enough, mm-hmm. is getting much more coverage these days than a lot of better books, front page New York Times book review, while they relegated the two brilliant biographies of John Maynard Keynes to page 15, it's my answer to Ayn Rand, among other things, and her book was 1,150
right.
pages in smaller print.
Yes, that is very true. I like the ideas you put forth in this book, too. And the thing is, it's almost like, well, it gives you a sort of, yeah, well, why don't they do that? You know, my first thought before I actually looked into who these 17 billionaires and multimillionaires were who you chose to save the world was, that it seems as if most of the uber wealthy tend to be Republicans, that that these people have more money and wealth and stuff than they can ever use, but still seem to want more and work to enact laws and even tax codes so they can amass even more ridiculous wealth. How difficult was it to come up with enough of the super wealthy to make this feasible?
Not that difficult, even though it amounts to less than 1 or 2% of the super rich. Most of them are in their latter years, are, you know, they're relaxing, playing golf, long lunches, and monitoring their investments. But there are always a few who in their past have done good things. Warren Buffett, for example, worked with William Gates Sr. to save the estate tax in real life when the Republicans were trying to axe it a few years ago.
Right.
And he also just went a few weeks ago in real life to the Senate, met with senators of the Democratic Party persuasion, and urged them to raise taxes on the rich like him because he is undertaxed. He said he only paid 16% federal income tax last year, and his secretary paid 25%. So I picked them for, you know, different things that they've done for the public in the past. And it's interesting to note that the entire book, all the action, I mean, they just turned the country into a tremendously exciting state of ferment. And they knew they couldn't do it by themselves. They had to mobilize the community. Every congressional district had a Congress watchdog group. There was a Clean Elections Party fielding candidates, primarily against the old House and Senate leadership that, you know, never saw a competitor in 20, 30 years in their home district. But the entire action is $15 billion, which is less than a third of Warren Buffett's fortune, one man. So, you know, the right-wing multi-billionaires, they pour a lot of money in. Look at Scaife of the Mellon fortune. He's put $500 million into political candidates and helping expand Heritage Foundation and others. But on our side, so to speak, you have these wonderful citizen groups from all issues, and they're just starving. And as we speak, 2,000 lobbyists are swarming over Capitol Hill for the drug industries, the health insurance companies like Aetna, and the hospital chains. There isn't one full-time lobbyist for single-payer health insurance, which, of course, is the majority choice for the American people and preferred by a majority of doctors and nurses. It's this kind of mismatch that I wanted to drive home in great detail in my book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. And the details are to make it realistic, step by step, how they did this, top down, bottom up. And there's a lot to learn in this, and tactics and strategy. I put a lot of my experience in this. I hope it'll be used in high school and college government courses someday. But the important thing is that our side is starved. You know, there's never been a time in American history when there are better and more muckraking books exposing every industry, every company that's abused, Halliburton and Enron and WorldCom and Blackwater and Citigroup and you name it. And there's never been a greater time for expose documentaries like Sicko. It's the golden age of documentaries. And nothing happens.
You're right.
Nothing happens. Yeah. And if the liberal and progressive intelligentsia think that by continuing to do what they're doing, that anything's going to change, they're living in a dystopia. And between the dystopia on the ground that's blocking anything, I'll prefer my practical utopia in this book as an agenda motivator.
Ralph Nader is with us here on Air America Radio. We're talking about his new book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. We'll take a break and come back with more. We'll be right back. Ralph Nader is with us this evening on Air America Radio. We're talking about his brand new book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. And it makes so much logical sense. You've got someone like Warren Buffett, who was an Obama supporter during the election. We know, and the other people who, you know, who you've named seem like they would come to the party. Have you spoken to any of the principals in the book? Have you gotten reaction?
Yes. When the book came out, I sent them an early copy, wrote them a personal letter, each one of them, and spoke to some of them on the phone. I had breakfast with Warren Buffett about 5 weeks ago in Omaha, at which point he hadn't yet read the book, but he knew, he clearly knew by our discussion what was in it. And so Ted Turner wrote, Yoko Ono wrote, you know, Phil Donahue, I've spoke to him. They'll get around to reading it. Obviously, they don't want to say anything until they see the whole book, you know, until they read the book, because it has a lot of conversation and dialogue, and I'm sure they want to be aware of all that. But I hope other mega millionaires and billionaires read the book. You don't need many, you know. If seven or eight multi-billionaires, let's say George Soros, Ted Turner, Carl Icahn, Warren Buffett, got together and threw in a total of $1 billion to organize every congressional district for single payer, and I'm not saying this flippantly, $1 billion organized to get single payer health insurance through Congress, when Congress, 30% of them are already privately for single payer, and Obama would sign it, would get single payer in 18 months. That's saving 45,000 American lives a year, who the two Harvard researchers estimated die every year because they can't afford health insurance to get treatment.
Right.
That's in a peer-reviewed article, just came out in the December issue of Journal of Public Health.
And I've interviewed one of the authors of the study on this show. So,
yeah, there you are.
Yep.
Now, what's $1 billion?
I mean, there are rich people
who give $5 billion to start a family foundation, or they give half $1 billion to some to build some university construct. Buffett himself is in the process of giving over $30 billion to the Gates Foundation. So we have to think big, and we have to step it up. The abolitionist movement against slavery, the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s, they benefited from multimillion-dollar families who contributed to them, proper Bostonians in the abolitionist case, funded a lot of the anti-slavery movement. It took money. It takes money to work for justice. It takes organizers, transportation expenses, media, you name it. And the liberal and progressive intelligentsia is clueless. Even though they're begging for money for their own, you know, nonprofit institutions, environmental, consumer, anti-poverty, women's rights, civil rights, they are not stepping it up. They're not saying to the progressive, enlightened, older, when they're older, the super rich have a different perspective when they're in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, some of them at least. They're not saying, look, we want you to give commensurate with your assets.
Right.
And, you know, that's no big deal. And I think if we do, huge change can come to this country that's long overdue, and it's the kind of change that's consonant with the rhythms of the people. It's not a jarring change. It's a lot of it is a change that occurred 30, 50 years ago in Western Europe. You know, the decent public transit, better wages and pensions, 4-week paid vacation for all the people there, universal health care, paid maternity leave, paid family sick leave, paid daycare, and tuition-free university,
right,
et cetera. All this came after they were destroyed in World War II through their multi-party system, not a two-party tyranny that we have now. So I think this is throwing the gauntlet down to the Jim Hightowers and the Bill Griders and the Bob Kuttners and Gloria Steinems and others, and saying, look, face it, your careers are going very well. You're writing books, you're giving lectures, you know, you're not getting rich, but you're comfortable. But you're not going anywhere unless we solve the resource deprivation problem, unless we get more money behind prison reform and the whole boomeranging war on drugs, and not to mention, of course, that the war in Iraq could have been stopped by $50 million from George Soros, for example.
Wow.
You want to know how?
Yes,
here's
please.
Here's how. We all remember Bush started beating the drums in the 9 months before March 2003, when he launched a criminal war of aggression, unconstitutionally and violating treaties and everything, on a basis of lies and false pretenses and cover-ups.
Right.
Well, in that period, there were 300 to 400 retired generals, admirals, CIA, former NSA leaders, Brent Scowcroft, Jim Baker, former leading diplomats, former Secretary of State, Assistant Secretary of this and that, both under Republican and Democratic administrations, who spoke out against the war. They had op-eds against the war. They went on radio against the war. They some of them even wrote letters, public letters against the war. But nobody organized them for the next step. Nobody provided them with a secretariat, with mass media, with putting them on major talk shows to rebut the massive stampede of lies by Cheney and Bush. And nobody organized them to focus on Congress. Now, these are extremely credible people, right? I mean, they can't be accused of being partisan. They're bipartisan. They've fought in the wars. They've been in diplomatic assignments. They've run security institutions in the country. They would have stopped Bush. But they had nothing. They got their op-ed out. Baker, Scowcroft, you know, the two major advisors to Bush's father, for heaven's sake. But they didn't take the next step. There wasn't that facility. There wasn't that resource. That's why I'm trying to get the progressive and liberal people to start stepping up, because they're not going to create a new party. They'll always go with the least worst of the Democrats over the Republicans. Mm-hmm. So they lose that political lever completely.
Words of wisdom from Ralph Nader. We are talking about his new book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, and looking at practical terms on how this plan actually could work to turn the country around. We got lots more with Ralph Nader coming up. I'm Nicole Sandler. Thanks for hanging out. We'll be right back. Nader is with us. We're speaking about, among other things, basing our conversation on his new book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, and this theory put forth that these people, a handful of the uber wealthy in this country, really could turn things around. And, you know, it's sort of playing out on the right. We know now that less than 20% of Americans are self-identified as Republicans. The party's just falling apart. Yet there's this very conservative movement that's starting. They're trying to paint it as grassroots. Yet we know that it's AstroTurf. There's a lot of money being poured into these PR campaigns by groups like FreedomWorks and others. And again, it's coming from money going down to organize these teabagging rallies and these marches on Washington. And it's making it look like a bigger thing than it is. And these people are actually having some sway in Congress, but it's not coming from the ground up. It's coming from big money on the right trying to get the people mobilized that believe what they're trying to push.
Exactly. And you know, they're bankrolling all kinds of candidates. They're putting ads in newspapers. They're paying transportation expenses, et cetera, for people who gather together to protest. Now, they know how to play that game. And, you know, our side, you know, they have these foundations that are restricted by the tax laws and not going into political action. But they certainly could go into civic action, but they're reluctant to do that. It's only the super rich that's completely free of all these requirements over nonprofit foundations and so on. They can really be the catalyst, be the shoehorn, give the grassroots leadership that's there, but they have, you know, they have no jobs to pay for their livelihoods. Thousands and thousands of neighborhood and community organizers around a set agenda. Now, what made this book work as a work of fiction that was really realistic is that the 17 very rich, when they met in Maui, and they went back every month to, you know, extend the strategy because they wanted isolation. What made it work is they agreed ahead of time on an agenda. It's on page 76 in the book. Seven redirections, they called them, in America. They called themselves meliorists, people who better things. And so there was minimal friction as they moved forward and as they entered the titanic power collision struggle with the giant CEOs led by a Darth Vader character named Lancelot Lobo, whose allies were, among others, right-wing talk show hosts with huge audiences, Bush Bimbo and Pawn Vanity. So I hope people will read it. You know, they read novels of that length.
That's right.
The print is large. I want older people to read it. It moves well, and it's very instructive. I think anyone who reads this book will have a high likelihood of coming out with three reactions. One, they'll come out feeling stronger as a citizen, with a higher grasp of what's possible and very realistic in a short time in this country. And second, they'll have a very engrossing read, as Leslie Stahl put it. And third, they'll never be as inhibited again asking very rich people to contribute to their social justice causes.
That's a good outcome. Ralph Nader, I know you're going to be here. I broadcast from Miami, and you're going to be speaking and reading from the book at the Miami Book Fair International Sunday, November 15th at 10 a.m. It's a wonderful event, and hopefully I'll see you there.
Yes, thank you.
I want to ask you this. We are now a year since this country elected Barack Obama president. It's a milestone. How do you grade his performance so far?
Well, his rhetoric is more humane, obviously, than the coarse, belligerent rhetoric of Bush and Cheney. But, you know, he came into office with a certain personality that does not lend itself to being a transforming leader. He's a harmony person.
Mm-hmm.
He's conflict-averse. He does not like to take on corporate power. He likes to sit down with CEOs in the White House at great frequency compared to the very, very rare instance he invites civic leaders to the White House whose membership helped elect him. And he's being betrayed by them. Of the drug companies rolled him. They got him to agree to things which are outrageous, like Uncle Sam would not negotiate for volume discounts in drugs that the taxpayer pays for.
Unbelievable.
And, of course, the health insurance companies are laughing all the way to the bank. I mean, they're going to get another 30 million customers with no real controls. And whatever controls are in the legislation, they can design around by increasing deductibles and raising premiums. Very disappointing. And the financial regulation of Wall Street crooks and speculators, very slow. And Barney Frank is slicing off proposals that are made by some more progressive Democrats there, and the bill that's moving forward. So I don't expect much from Chris Dodd either. The banking industry is not remorseful for being bailed out and tanking the economy and unemploying workers. They're swarming over Capitol Hill, demanding continued deregulation and opposing any split Glass-Steagall Act-like that Clinton got rid of, which caused a good part of this destabilized speculative binge.
It certainly did.
They still want commercial banking and investment banking under the same roof, which is a classic formula for wild derivative speculation with other people's money, like pension money and mutual fund money. So here we go again. So I think, A, he's very concessionary to corporations. When he really has the golden age of corporate reform. There's no time I remember when corporations are in lower repute in the polls, lower repute in people's experience of what they've done to hardworking people by the greed at the top of these corporations. And unfortunately, he's not taking advantage of it, and he's losing momentum quite rapidly as they realize in the corporate world that he can be rolled, if they didn't know already. Overseas, very belligerent. Different rhetoric from Bush, huge quagmire expansion of the occupation of Afghanistan, and that fuels the resistance, and that bands together the various disparate factions that we all stereotype as the Taliban, some of them just trying to protect their valleys and their turf. It unites them against more and more soldiers occupying their country, drones blowing up civilians, by accident, of course, et cetera, et cetera. So, and he's still not out of Iraq. He's still 130,000 soldiers in Iraq. And he's announced a kind of Obama doctrine, like Bush, like, we'll go anywhere in the world. Yeah, well, what about international law? What about sovereignty? What about the boomeranging history of the U.S. going anywhere in the world? So very disappointing. And however, he was dealt a bad hand in terms of what he inherited, an economic situation from Bush. But that doesn't excuse him from turning his back on the liberal community. He doesn't want to appear with liberal leaders. He doesn't want to appear in the White House with Jesse Jackson, but he's appeared with the head of Aetna five times. So, you know, we have to begin characterizing his character and personality here to try to send him a message, which is he's going to lose, he may lose a house or two in the Congress in 2010, because a lot of people are so disillusioned. Even Bob Herbert in the New York Times has pointed out, his friends tell him they're upset with Obama because he treats them like they have nowhere to go. All that has to happen is people stay home, just like 1994, which gave it to Gingrich.
Well, that's it. And, you know, I consider myself among the more liberal of the citizens in this country. And he, as you said, he's totally disenfranchised us, his base in this election. And I worry. I it looks like since the Republicans seem to be moving so far to the right, Obama is too. Do I have that perception right?
Yeah, very right. That's where the pull is, because the liberal side knows that they're left with no one but Obama. They're not going to say we're going to go to the Republican side, but so they make no demands on Obama, and that's what happens every 4 years. They make no demands on the least worst choice that they make. Therefore, the Kerrys and the Obamas can turn their back on them, knowing they have their votes in the pocket, and then start flirting with the corporatist ideology and becoming more like the Republicans. And that's been going on every 4 years. You know, you can see that he came into office with 13 million email names during his presidential campaign, and they can barely activate a fraction of those. They're not excited.
Right. So barring somebody coming in with billions of dollars to inject into the system, how do we turn things around? That's the question I'll ask when we return with Ralph Nader here on Air America Radio. Don't go away.
Listening to Nicole Sandler on Air America Radio.
It is Nicole Sandler with you on this Wednesday night, November 4th, 2009. And my special guest tonight is Ralph Nader. We are talking about his new book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. So, short of having a Warren Buffett and a group of 16 other uber wealthy people who have the right motives in mind, taking action as they do in the book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, how do we turn things around?
Well, as long as the liberals and the progressives do not say to the Democrats, we're going to deny you the vote and put it in a third party candidate, they have no lever. Because no Democratic nominee is going to believe that they're going to abandon them for the Republicans. And this my campaign manager has put this out in a brilliant book just out called The Grand Illusion, The Myth of Voter Choice in a Two-Party Tyranny. Mm-hmm. Teresa Amato is her name. And her analysis is that every 4 years, the more extreme right the Republicans become, and since the Democrats are dialing for the same corporate dollars, the more the Democrats move to the right, because millions of people who vote for the Democrats will never abandon them. And therefore, they lose their bargaining power. And they basically say to the Democratic nominee, take us, we're yours, and they take them. And so that's a very good interview, by the way. She's very articulate in this. As long as we have these ballot access obstructions, all the harassment that we experienced in 2004, especially when the Democrats sued us 24 times in 18 states in 12 weeks in the summer of 2004 and harassed our people on the streets, and that's a long story, but she describes it in the book Grand Delusion. As long as that happens, we have to rely on the super rich. But look, suppose $1 billion was put into moving on corporate reform. Grassroots, always in congressional districts, because we have to say, look, there are 535 members of Congress who put their shoes on every day like you and I. 1,500 corporations get their way with most of them. None of those corporations have any votes. They have money, no votes. We're the ones who have the votes. So if we organize 2,000 people in every congressional district with two full-time staff, that'll take about $85 to $100 million a year. And then eventually get it self-sustaining, because all it would take would be $200-$300 raised from each of those 200 people, 2,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd have a completely different politics. Let's say $1 billion was put to set up a permanent sentinel, so never again will be plunged unconstitutionally and criminally in a war of aggression. We're using all the retired people. Look at that combat Marine captain who just quit the Foreign Service.
Oh, yeah, Ho, Matthew Ho.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of very conscious people, but they don't have a facility. They don't have resources to reach out to all kinds of people, including people in the American Legion, VFW. They're not all of one gung-ho persuasion. So the same with anything like this. Let's say living wage. What if someone puts $100 million in grassroots organizing to get the minimum wage up to what it was in 1968, adjusted for inflation, which would be $10 an hour. Hey, you know, the economy's doubled, productivity per worker's doubled. Why not a federal minimum wage, at least in purchasing power, what it was when the economy was half the size in 1968? Well, it's now $7.25, having just gone up in July, the federal minimum wage. So you take your cause, take your favorite cause, and price it out. I mean, we've got the money is there, but nobody's sitting down with these people. Nobody's putting proposals on their desk. And once one or two or three of the billionaires break and start doing this, it'll become more and more the thing to do, just like the first contributors to the Metropolitan Opera, the wealthy contributors, and pretty soon others. Pretty soon they have a very successful annual dinner, right? There's an emulation factor here. Philanthropy started out centuries ago to churches in Europe and the U.S. They gave to their church. And then the philanthropy expanded to the secular foundations, Carnegie, Ford Foundation, Rockefeller. And now it's got to move big time into social justice movements to give millions of Americans who have no resource, no media hardly, are very discouraged, very demoralized, the kind of lift that will generate their own civic metabolism. And pretty soon, more and more and more, they'll be rooted themselves and self-sustaining.
Yes, and it's a wonderful utopian picture you paint. But the question is, how do we get from here to there? In the book, in Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, Ralph Nader with us here, you mentioned the Clean Elections Party, which I just love the idea of that. Now, I think this is sort of a, you know, chicken and the egg battle. Which do we need first? We need sort of the infusion of capital, or do we need to clean up our election system, deal with the corporate personhood myth that has become reality in this country? Do we need to fix that before we can get a third or fourth party in here to try to change things?
Well, first you need the resources. Then you have two tracks, the civic mobilization at the community level and the political electoral track, side by side. They both make each other effective, and they're both necessary for one another. And then all these other things that you mentioned begin flowing naturally. There's a fun part of the book where William Gates Sr. has these huge jamborees where persuading people that corporations have unique advantages as artificial persons that real human beings don't, tax advantages and all kinds of things. And so he provides free lawyers so that all these people can incorporate themselves. And he has these huge rows of delicious lunch, and they come in and they incorporate themselves. John Doe, Jane Smith. With awareness, hey, if corporations are going to have privileges and immunities that we normal human beings don't have, let's become corporations. Well, that's just to get people thinking about all this As you know, Tom Hartman wrote a great book on the history of...
I know, and Tom was on my show just last week talking about it because this has been a major issue for me. I think most people, it's not such a sexy topic. A lot of people aren't aware of the whole corporate personhood issue.
But more than ever, you know, thanks to Poclag and Richard Grossman, who started the discussion around the country, I used to talk about abolishing corporate personhood. Nobody would know what I was talking about mm-hmm. in an auditorium with 1,000 people.
Amazing.
Now I'm really surprised how spontaneous applause breaks out.
Really? As you can tell, we are getting at the end of the hour. I don't normally keep a guest on for this long, but it's a fascinating conversation we're having with Ralph Nader. So we're going to carry it over to the next hour. And we'll talk a little bit more about corporate personhood when we return, and what the upcoming Supreme Court ruling on Citizens United versus the Federal Elections Commission could mean. I'm Nicole Sandler, back with more of Ralph Nader. Don't go away.
There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
And welcome back to hour two of our nightly get-together here on Air America Radio. I'm Nicole Sandler, celebrating a wonderful birthday tonight, speaking with Ralph Nader. You know, I originally had Mr. Nader scheduled for a 30-minute interview, which would have filled about an hour of programming with my, you know, intros and outs and my commentary and everything else. But we were so having a great time. It turned out to be this wonderful conversation, so we just kept talking. So we'll continue with our conversation with Ralph Nader. His new book is called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. And before we had to break, we were talking about the idea of corporate personhood. So we'll pick up there. We are awaiting a decision from the Supreme Court on the Citizens United versus Federal Elections Commission ruling, which would not only reaffirm the idea of corporate personhood, but lift all kind of ceilings on corporate campaign contributions.
That's right.
Might that be the impetus for the uprising we need to say enough is enough already?
It could be. I've said if they come out the pro-corporate way, and it looks that way.
Yeah.
Although they'd be making a big mistake from their own ideology, Scalia and Roberts and
yep.
Alito and
yep.
Thomas. Now, it'll really, I'm not saying it'll lead to a breakthrough, but it will galvanize. I mean, people will just be extraordinarily outraged the Constitution doesn't even mention the word corporation. How can some artificial entity, global corporations that have no allegiance to any countries except to control them, how in the world can corporations be given all the constitutional rights that we have as real human beings, except the Fifth Amendment? I mean, it's so absurd. Would we do that to a robot? Let's say you had a huge robot that could raise capital, hire people, and produce widgets. Would we give this mega robot constitutional rights? We're not talking about the employees now of corporations. This
right.
is the corporate entity.
No, but again, this goes back to the super wealthy who tend to be Republicans,
yeah.
And hoard the money. And if they could find a way to make money off it and become even more obscenely wealthy,
yeah.
then they would.
But you see, to educate people in this book, Only Super Rich Can Save Us, which, by the way, is in quotes, it's a cry of of thanks by a grandmother after Katrina on the side of the road with her extended family when Warren Buffett brought truckloads of supplies down because nobody was providing these people with water and food. And she thanked him with that cry, only super rich can save us. And it haunted him all the way back to Omaha. And that's when he thought up the concept of bringing these people to Maui. But in the book, William Gates Sr., to educate people, selected a number of corporations to run for public office. He was saying, hey, if corporations are people, are persons, why can't they run for public office? As long as they're 35 years old or 25 years old. And people are saying, what? He actually named them funny names that drove the point home. I'm trying to get people to imagine. You know, if we don't imagine real possibilities, which is what practical utopian thinking does, then we're not going to reach. If we don't reach, we're not going to grasp. Do you know, I don't think this book has been reviewed by a single liberal intellectual.
Really?
Yeah. I've sent it to a lot of people. I've sent it to my friends I've worked with. And I always promote my friends' books. And when they don't sell all the books, I buy the remainders. Like I bought Hightower's remainders, and I send them out every week to key people, young people who want to be introduced into that. But the problem with progressives, and they got to start introspecting more, is they don't help one another the way the conservatives do. The conservatives have a farm team. You know, it's called the Dartmouth Review, for example. And they'll pick someone on the Dartmouth Review, get them published in Forbes or Wall Street Journal, get them introduced to key people in Congress, and voila, you have Miss Ingraham, who's a syndicated radio talk show.
Yes, we know her all too well, unfortunately.
See, so the progressive got to cut out this insularity. They're into their own careers, you know, and they get the lectures and the books and the articles and so forth. It's almost a kind of narcissism, and I'm really throwing the gauntlet down on these people. I have not gotten on Bill Moyers. I have not gotten on Charlie Rose. I have never gotten on Terry Gross. She's a political bigot. I can go into detail on that. And I can't even get on the D.C.-based Diane Rehm. Now, this is public TV and public radio. And more than once, I have seen them with right-wingers like Bill Kristol. Yeah. I've seen Charlie Rose with all kinds of CEOs. You see, our side doesn't demand enough. They don't protest enough. The right wing turned poor Dan Rather into a supposed radical in order to intimidate him at CVS years ago. But our side, with our own tax dollars supporting, you know, all these public radio and public TV, there's no demand there. I wasn't exactly dropped in Washington from a UFO. I know all these people.
Yes.
I've gotten a lot of legislation through. If they can black out me, they can black out anybody. Still no protest.
Has Amy Goodman had you on?
Yes.
Well, oh, good.
She's a great exception.
She's amazing. Okay, well, I'm glad to hear that. And
Laura Flanders hasn't.
Really? Well, you see, the problem is with liberals is that we try to be fair. We try to present all sides. And in trying to put that image forward, sometimes some of them, I think, bend over too far to appease the right, which is what our president is doing. And I take a lot of flack for saying that, but it's how I feel.
It's not only how you feel, it's accurate.
It's the truth,
right. It's factually accurate. If you went back the lists of who gets invited on these shows, it's disgraceful, utterly one-sided. Because the right wing in Congress is intimidated public radio and public TV.
Mm-hmm.
Under Bush, they did more than that. They controlled it. So, with the directors being chosen in the Public Broadcasting Corporation and so on. Now, I've been on a 23-city tour, and I must say the local press much more responsive.
Well, that's good.
Very good articles in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, the Minneapolis paper, San Francisco, Portland. But it's the national media that I'm trying to get on so we can really raise our level of feasibility here and tremendously turn around the progressive and liberal movements in this country that are in a terrible rut. I have this scene in the book where the Cato Institute once in a while decides to invite a progressive for their luncheons. Their luncheons are pretty well known here. And so they invite someone called Lob Corsage. You got it? You got it? Okay. And he gives a speech. And the whole thing is written for the reality on just how pathetic these people are. They'll put their conferences on. Rob Borsage puts on an annual conference in the Washington Hilton.
Uh-huh.
He has not invited me since 2000. I spoke to introduce Mike Gravel in 2004. But I mean, that's how petty they are.
Well, you know, Ralph Nader, part of the issue is, I'm sure, people perceived you in 2000 as a spoiler. There are those who said if you hadn't been in the race, that John Kerry would have won. And
no, you mean Al Gore.
I mean Al Gore, I'm sorry.
Yeah, but of course, but you see, they know better. These are the intellectuals. They're supposed to respond to evidence. They should ask Al Gore, who thinks he won not only the popular vote nationwide, but he won in Florida, but it was stolen from Tallahassee to the Supreme Court. He doesn't even blame the Greens. And where do they get off, you know, saying that this the two parties own all the voters? I can give you 17 what-ifs, not counting the Green Party, where if Gore won the state of Tennessee, everything else being even,
mm-hmm.
he'd have been president.
Right.
Now, all the shenanigans still going on in Florida. If he won Arkansas, he'd have been president. If he was smarter in the way he clashed with the Republicans right after the voting count mess in Florida,
mm-hmm.
he'd have won. If they caught the Secretary of State before elections hiring a consulting firm that basically misnamed thousands of people as ex-felons, because they had similar names to felons
yep.
and stripped
yep.
them of their right to vote.
Yeah, again, I'm in Florida. I
yeah,
know about that one.
Every major third-party candidate in Florida got more than 527 votes. And would they say the same for Buchanan? Hey, Pat Buchanan, you
mm-hmm.
like Nader. You shouldn't have run.
Right.
Well, they loved Pat Buchanan running, didn't they?
Yeah.
And what he did to Bush in New Mexico and other states by their version. So we have to get over it. Everyone has a right to run. Everyone has a right to get votes from one another. Get over it. Because otherwise you are supporting a two-party tyranny, and in the most anti-civil libertarian sense that you would never do in other political realms.
Ralph Nader is our special guest tonight on Air America Radio. We'll take a break, come back with one more segment, and then we'll take a look at President Obama's administration 1 year after we elected him. Stick around. We'll wrap it up with Ralph Nader next. Nicole Sandler back with you and Ralph Nader for one final segment as we wrap up a wonderful conversation that all stems from his new book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. And, of course, we sort of went off in different directions from there. I wish we would see the rise of third or fourth parties or fifth parties. My problem with it is it seems like the Green Party tends to surface around major elections, but they're not always there. I think we need more consistency from our third parties.
Yeah.
But again,
well, they need to be.
Yes.
They early on, they did pick it and connect with local things, but look, they got the same problem. They're not able to raise money. I mean,
right.
They nominated Cynthia McKinney and raised their less than $200,000 for a presidential race across the whole United States. Disgraceful. Are they serious or are they just a bunch of people who are concerned? There's a difference between being concerned and being serious. We have the resource problem, you see,
right.
Once again.
But they're not going to get the public to take them seriously until they're a force, an always there force.
That's right. The system was imprinted on us over 200 years ago, and it's a very, very self-destructive system. An electoral college, winner-take-all, two-party-dominated system garnished by gerrymandered districts where 93% of the members of Congress run, in effect, slam-dunk re-election, either Republican or Democrat. So it's a very sick, paralytic system. It can't get anything done. Compared to even a parliamentary system, as in Western Europe or Canada.
Ralph Nader, I know you've been very gracious with your time. We've gone a lot longer than we were supposed to. I have two quick final questions for you. First is 2012. Any chance you would run again?
Well, I want the progressive agenda before the voters. I've run 3 times officially. I wish someone else would. As far as your question is concerned, it's too early to say.
Okay.
But, you know, why would anyone want to do this 4 times? Answer? Because none of the other liberal progressive leaders are willing to go through the grueling grind. You know, they want to do their lectures and write their books. So that's the problem we have in this country. We don't have enough progressive and liberal leaders who put their time and their reputation on the line state after state. I campaigned in every state 3 times, 50 states.
Wow.
I don't believe in, you know, like the Republicans and Democrats write off states that are either high Republican or high Democratic controlled. That's disrespecting the voter. But, you know, the Greens can't even get more than 200-300 people running for local and out of 2.5 million seats. So there's a real sickness here, a real malaise. It could be that the liberal and progressive leaders are too estranged from working families, and they're too comfortable, the liberal leaders and progressive leaders, utterly too comfortable. And we've got to get the resources down to the grassroots so that these wonderful leaders that are emerging or that are frustrated because they have no resources can coalesce and begin transforming our nation. We know they're out there. I meet them all the time. They are almost bereft of any budget. They got the tin cup out.
Right.
And they're trying to turn around a horrible situation where 80,000 people live in a poor area of a city and taking a lot of risks and so forth. And it's disgraceful that we have not developed the kind of thought that's in this book and put it into action.
Well,
because
all right.
the money is there. And the website for more ideas from your listeners, onlythesuperrich.org, onlythesuperrich.org.
Great. Well, I will definitely put a link to that. All right, so final question is, you planted a huge seed with this book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. Will, rather than running maybe in 2012, are you going to take it to the next level and try to meet with these people who you name in the book and try to convince a few of them to come to the party?
I am. The former editor of Harper's, Lou Lapham, would like to have at Columbia University a conference where we have at least 4 or 5 of these people and some other super rich get the ball rolling. That's what it's going to take. They're going to have to come together. They're going to have to think about these things. But, you know, someone's got to put plans on their desk. You know, I on my book tour, and you know, we try to favor independent bookstores, but we do Barnes & Noble and Borders as well. On my book tour, I met someone who was on a hospital board, and a rich person was on the board with that person. And the person found out that the rich person had given $6 million to another hospital. So he came up to him. He said, "What's going on here? You're on the board of this hospital. You give $6 million to another hospital." And the rich guy answered, "Well, you didn't present me with a $6 million idea."
Wow.
See what I mean?
I see exactly what you mean. All right.
Yeah.
Ralph Nader, what a pleasure this has been. Thank you so much for joining me today. And I look forward to reading the book. I've got to go spend a week on a beach somewhere so I can plug into it. But I will, because I love the ideas you put forth. It is definitely a utopian novel. And, you know, we can only hope that fiction becomes truth.
That's what the comment by Tom Peters on the top of the book. He says it's a wonderful piece of nonfiction, of fiction, which I hope would become nonfiction or real. And so thank you for your listeners. Viva Air America. And let's take it to the next step at the Miami Book Fair. Hope to see you there.
Terrific. It's Sunday, November 15th. You'll be speaking and reading from the book at 10 a.m. Ralph Nader, a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Not really what I expected. Although I can't explain what I expected, just I enjoyed that a whole lot more than I thought I was going to.